Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to our 2015 Iditarod coverage here on Mushing Radio. And I'd like to bring in my co-host calling in from Southern California. His name is Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. Since the last time we talked, we had quite a few finishers, and there's now 25 teams that have made it into Nome and another 43 still out on the trail.
They're all making their way. We're going to talk about the crazy weather that they're having in between Shaktulik and Koyuk here in just a second. But, you know, after we went off the air on Tuesday, nobody had finished the race yet. And Dallas Seavey finished about 4 o'clock in the morning on Wednesday morning, and then they started trickling in there pretty quickly after that. So we do have to give a big congratulations to Dallas. Way to go on his third Iditarod win. And I think we're looking at a dynasty. What do you think?
Yeah, I think we really are. And between Dallas and Mitch, although they do have separate kennels, but between Dallas and Mitch, we've had CV victories for the last 4 years. And in fact, Mitch came in second place this year, just about 4 hours behind his son Dallas. So they have similar approaches to how they run, and they have similar attitudes towards towards the Iditarod. And obviously, they are both very competitive with each other. But I think that we are looking at a period where, even if we don't see CV wins for the next few years, we are definitely going to have one or both of the CVs in contention, probably for the next 3 or 4 years at least.
Alex, can you talk about, or would you like me to, about the cycle of a team mushing? I know we saw it a lot in the mid-2000s with Lance. He was very high there, of course, winning several Iditarods in a row for 4 or 5 years. And then he sort of went by the wayside a little bit, and you see that often in dog teams. Do you know much about that, or would you like me to expound?
Well, I know a little bit about it, so why don't I start, and then you can jump in and correct me where I'm wrong. It is more of an art form than a science to assembling a great dog team, and it requires, if you're going to have a team, an Iditarod team or a Yukon Quest team of 14 to 16 very powerful, strong, dominant dogs, you are looking at needing to have a kennel that is, I would imagine, at least 50 dogs. And within those 50 dogs, you are breeding, you are bringing up yearlings, you are trying to get the yearlings trained. And then it seems that when you have a very, very dominant team, there's always a great lead dog. And unfortunately, dogs have a much shorter lifespan than human beings. So a lead dog in a dominant team generally will only have maybe 4 or 5 or if you're lucky, 6 or 7 years of real peak performance.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was going to say there. And aside from Lance Mackey's health, that was what was probably happening with him. He had a very strong dog team. He had a very cohesive, complete group of dogs for that period of time where he was doing very, very well. And that can lead to reason why he was doing so well. And what I think is also kind of in that same juncture is where Allie Zirkle is with her group of dogs, and in particular, her little big dog. I believe her name or possibly his name is Quinto, is that right, or Quinto?
I believe that's right, yeah.
Right, so we're seeing that cycle sort of happening with Allie, where she's been very dominant for the last 4 or 5 years. I believe what is she went second 3 or 4 years in a row, which is it, Alex?
Right. It's 3 years in a row, and then this year she was a little bit farther back. She was in 5th. But that is still a very, very dominant performance to be able to be that close to the lead for so many years.
Before we get into our topics tonight, Alex, we want to talk about the Rookie of the Year. We had showcased this musher a few nights ago. What do you have to say about our Rookie of the Year this year?
Yeah, you know, Thomas Werner from Norway was actually running behind Jason Campo for most of the last, for several hundred miles. And then Jason, I believe, ran into some open water on the Golovin Lagoon and stopped for a while, at which point Thomas overtook him and managed to come in just about 50 minutes ahead of Jason Campo. So very, very strong performances by both of those rookies who came in 17th and 18th.
Right.
As we discussed, you can always – the Norwegian teams seem to be very, very strong, and it looks likely that we are going to see and hear a lot from Thomas Werner over the next few years.
I think so, too. I think he's going to be one of those teams to be reckoned with over the next few years. As we had mentioned before, there's always that one – team that really puts themselves on the radar, and I think him or Jason, who is running a team that he purchased this past spring, early summer from Jake Berkowitz. Jake sold his team and moved, I believe he moved to Calgary, and he purchased his team and is doing very well, obviously, with his run as a rookie. If we could, Alex, I want to mention real quick about one scratch that we've had since we've been on, Jim Lanier. He had scratched due to sickness. Oh, he was sick. And did you happen to see the story right before air? I read this story about Rick Casillo, who has been bedded down for the last 36 hours or so in Shaktulik, dealing with pneumonia. Did you hear that story?
I heard the story. I haven't heard any details about it, and obviously that's a very serious situation, especially in Shaktulik this year, where people coming out of Shaktulik are facing very, very stiff winds. Luckily, it has warmed up considerably, but still, when you're facing winds of 35 or 40 miles per hour, it is very difficult to move forward. It's not clear to me if he will be able to continue. Obviously, a lot depends on how he's feeling and how severe his condition is. But it would not be too surprising to me if he were to scratch sometime in the next day or so.
That's got to be a rough thing to deal with on the trail, getting sick like that. You know, mushers drop out quite often for getting pretty ill on the trail. It really takes a lot out of you. Not to say that I've ever done anything like the Iditarod in terms of time or endurance, but I can imagine if you come down with something 600 or 700 miles into a 1,000-mile race, just how much that can hamper your plans on what you want to do in the next few days.
Right, especially since a lot of these mushers will talk about how once they're on the Iditarod Trail, they are getting, maybe if they're lucky, a couple of hours of sleep per day. So if your body is already run down and you're not able to really get sleep, and have a chance to heal up, that could make your physical condition go downhill very fast. I just wanted to mention, too, that Jim Lanier is a very colorful and interesting musher who always has a lot of good stories. He published a book, I believe, this past year, maybe the year before, called Beyond Ophir. And Jim Lanier is very quick to tell people that he is the only musher who has raced in five different decades in Iditarod, because
wow.
he first ran the race in 1979, and then he ran in the 80s, took years off, and ran again in the 90s, and then in the 2000s, and now for the past few years has been running. So Jim Lanier is one of these racers who is always very, very solidly in the middle of the pack, but someone who is dedicated to the sport and really is someone who just, you can tell that he gets a tremendous amount of enjoyment out of just being out on the trail.
So let's talk a little bit about that crazy weather happening up there in Shaktulik. We had mentioned that Rick has been bedded down for 3 days or so. A lot of teams were stuck for quite a ways there. For quite a few hours, and my first point of concern there is often you do not prepare for something like that. Nobody intends to stay 3 day, a day and a half, 36 hours in a checkpoint. They don't have enough food for their dogs for that long a time. So I would imagine things were getting pretty hairy there in the little village of Shaktulik.
Yes, and I believe there was a big group of mushers, possibly as many as 20 or so, who were basically stuck there or at least waiting for the weather to clear up a little bit. There was a very large exodus. I think there were maybe 15 or 16 who left within 90 minutes, making their way out over the ice up to Koyuk. And that was not easy going either. And we've seen very, very slow speeds of the teams that are out there. And we've seen some teams like Scott Jansen's team and Brian Bears, who's running the dog team for Karin Hendrickson, who were on the ice kind of hunkered down for a very long time. And clearly that's not something that you want to see, because the ice is, when you're on the ice, there's no protection from the wind. You have no trees around you that you can use to keep yourself out of the wind. You can turn your sled on its side and kind of hunker down that way. But most mushers that I've talked to have said that they are a little bit superstitious of the ice, and they know that they have to go out on the ice and go through it, but they don't want to spend more time out there than they need to. And in the past couple of years, we've seen some mushers who were out on the ice for quite a long time. I know that Q-Neff was stuck on the ice for a very, very long time, I believe last year, and then wound up being rescued, I believe, by one of the insider crews.
A snow machiner. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it was a snow machiner, if they were related to Iditarod or not. I just remember him having to get picked up and taken back to the checkpoint, and therein had to scratch or withdraw because of that. So yeah, that has to be a really bad part of the race. Just about any time of the race, it could be a very dicey situation. Do you know how far it is in terms of miles that they are on the ice, Alex?
From Shaktulik to Koyuk is 50 miles, and I believe about 35 of those miles are on the ice.
Right, and a little perspective, those guys are on the inlet of the Arctic Ocean, is that right?
Yeah.
So you're literally running over the ocean there, and I can understand some of that superstition. I just can't imagine being out there for 35 miles. And a little mushing perspective there, if your team is going 7 or 8 miles an hour, you're out on that ice 4 or 5 hours. That is a long time out in the middle of nowhere.
And ice does interesting and weird things when there's wind and there are ridges, and it can be very, very difficult going. It's not like you're on an ice rink where you've had a Zamboni clear a nice path. Also, this year, there seemed to be a lot of open water. So there was not nearly as much actual ice there. So I think that several of the teams have encountered overflow and open water there. And, I think that's part of the reason why people will prefer to run that section of the trail during daylight if they can, because you want to have as much visibility as possible when you're going through that section of the trail.
Exactly. Let's talk a little bit about our current Red Lantern participant or recipient, Cindy Abbott. I've been reading up on Vern Halter's page. If you don't know who Vern Halter is, Vern is a multiple Yukon Quest and Iditarod veteran, and he mentors Cindy Abbott. And we've talked about Cindy many a times on this show. And on his last post this morning, he's pretty confident in where she's at and how she's doing. Do you have anything to add to Cindy's story other than what Vern has posted this morning? Any news with her, Alex?
Yeah, she is. She recently got to Unalakleet, so she is now on the coast with all of the other teams. She had a very good run from Caltag. This is farther than she got 2 years ago when she broke her pelvis and then had to scratch, I believe, between Caltag and Unalakleet. And it seems as if she is doing very well. You know, you never want to jinx anything by assuming things before they will happen. But she does seem to be making really good progress. And there's always the specter of teams being withdrawn or highly encouraged to scratch if they are not competitive. And we've talked about that rule in the past. It seems to me that there's also some flexibility with that rule, and it's up to the discretion of the race marshal and the judges, which I know is very frustrating at times to some of the mushers and to some of the fans trying to figure out exactly how fast does someone have to be going and exactly, you know, what kind of runtime do they have to make. Jan Steves, who was who recently scratched, posted on Facebook that she was given specific run times that she needed to beat in order to be considered competitive, in order to have, you know, the continued allowance for her to continue. She didn't share exactly what those were, and I imagine that Cindy also has been given guidelines for how fast she needs to go and so that she doesn't fall too far behind. Having said that, Cindy Abbott's story is very inspirational. And, as someone who has a very serious degenerative disease and as someone who has climbed Mount Everest, and there has never been a female musher who has completed the Iditarod and climbed Mount Everest. So there is, I would say, a certain value in having her complete this if she's able to do that.
And one thing that's in her favor now, I believe, in particular, all the back of the packers there, is all those folks that were holed up there in Shaktulik. There's not such a discrepancy between the far back of the packers now and that group that's been pretty much stationary for the last day and a half.
Right. And, you know, in the past, there were times where there was an actual stop called on Iditarod and teams were told that they were not to proceed. I don't believe we've seen an official stop, certainly not in the last 10 years or so, at least not that I'm aware of. But having these kind of unofficial stops or having these situations where a dozen or 20 mushers will make the decision that they're going to hold somewhere really helps the back of the Packers because it gives them essentially a chance to catch up.
Exactly. And I think that's what's happening there with Cindy. And who are the other last few there? I'm not looking at the standings right now. Who's kind of back there with her at a checkpoint or so around her?
It's Trent Herbst, who is now between Unalakleet and Shaq Tulik. And then in Shaq Tulik is Cindy Galea and Lachlan Clark. And those four are the only ones who haven't left Shaq Tulik. As we talked about, there was a big in Shaq Tulik, and they have all pretty much left at this point.
So let's talk about our musher profile for today. Who are we going to talk about?
We're going to talk about Brian Wilmshurst. And again, please forgive me if I've mispronounced names, which I am sure I do quite a lot. Brian is from Dawson City in the Yukon, and unlike a great deal of the mushers, especially the young mushers competing in Iditarod, he did not come up as a dog handler working for another musher. He's largely self-taught, and he said that he learned a lot by just doing and racing and making mistakes, and also by relentlessly quizzing veteran mushers and veterinarians about race strategy and dog care. And he said that one of his favorite things to do is to just sit and talk dogs with people who've been racing for many, many years. He's been mushing. He only started mushing in 2008, and he's been racing since 2009. He was born in Peterborough, Ontario, but then he and his wife visited Dawson City while they were on a road trip in 2004, and they both completely fell in love with the area, and they stayed there over the summer to work and decided that they both really wanted to move there, which they did a couple years later. And he was working various tourist industry jobs, and then in 2007, he was working as a bus driver, and they had a tour that went to Whitehorse for the start of the Yukon Quest. And he went to the starting banquet for the Yukon Quest and then the start and just became instantly hooked on the excitement and the idea of being around a whole bunch of dogs and witnessing the power that you see every time the hook is pulled and dogs just go pulling a sled. So by the next winter, he and his wife had bought three dogs and a very beat-up sled, and then they bought a house that used to be a horse ranch and got six new dogs, so they had nine, and they started acquiring dogs and breeding, and currently their kennel has 35 dogs in it. He's finished the Yukon Quest four times and wants to be the first Canadian musher to finish both the Yukon Quest and the Iditarod in the same year. Although Americans and I believe some German mushers have done that, we've never had a Canadian who's finished the Quest and the Iditarod in the same year. I should mention also that Rob Cook, who's from Whitehorse, also finished the Quest this year and is running the Iditarod, the 2015 Iditarod, with a team of Siberian Huskies. So both Rob Cook and Brian Wilmshurst are rookies and Canadians, and they're both looking to try to be the first one to finish both of these races in the same year. Brian has said that, like a lot of mushers, he loves being out in the country, and he likes being alone with his dogs and isn't entirely comfortable being in large groups of people packed together very closely, and just enjoys being out where he's dependent on his own skills and the strengths of his dogs. He's something of an iconoclast. If you look at his official picture on Iditarod.com, he's wearing a tie-dye T-shirt. He said that his favorite music to listen to on the trail is Neil Young. And people who looked at or saw pictures of the ceremonial start in Anchorage might recognize that Brian was the musher who was wearing shorts because it was so warm in Anchorage and raced the entire 11-mile ceremonial start leg wearing shorts.
I didn't know, Alex, that he has only been racing since 2008 and already finished the Quest four times. That's really impressive, especially for somebody that has pretty much learned by his own rules, so to speak. He didn't work with others and didn't get that mentorship that so many do. That's a very impressive statistic. I did not know that.
Yeah, it really is, and especially now, it's hard to put together a kennel that has over 30 dogs, and it's hard to get all of your stuff together in order to be able to run a 1,000-mile race like the Yukon Quest, which, because it has much longer distances between the checkpoints and more hilly areas, is a lot of people consider the Quest to be a more difficult race technically than the Iditarod. And I just wanted to mention that currently Brian is in 48th place. He's on the ice between Shaq Tulik and Koyuk, and Rob Cook, the other Canadian who is a rookie and finished the Quest this year, is right behind him in 49th.
Wow, so it will be that battle for the first Canadian then. I believe both of those guys are doing very well. They're solidly, and as you mentioned, 48th and 49th. You know, Alex, I don't think we had mentioned this, but I've been told that pretty much it's the same trail from the start of the Yukon Quest all the way to Nome this year. So for folks that have ran both races, when you talk about Lance and Hugh and Brian and Rob, all those guys, they are running the same trail figuratively for 2,000 miles with a couple of week break in between there in Fairbanks.
Exactly, and they essentially will have run from Whitehorse all the way to Nome, which is a very impressive feat.
It's an awesome feat, in not so many words, for sure. Alex, we have a few minutes left. We'll probably run over if that's okay with you. I know you want to talk a little bit about the atmosphere at Nome. I know that you've been there at least once, maybe twice, I'm not sure. What's happening this week? What are the festivities like for all those folks that are there?
Well, you know, Nome is a very interesting place, especially around Iditarod time. And the entire community really is motivated to come out and support all of the racers. There is a law in Nome that I believe is still on the books, where it is against the law for a dog team to travel if they are not in city limits, if they do not have bells on the dog team so you can hear the team coming. And in the very first Iditarod in 1973, there was talk of among some of the people who were opposed to the race of having the teams arrested when they got to Nome for not having bells. And some of the race supporters then went out onto the ice with bells. So they gave the dog teams, as they were coming into Nome, bells so that they could not be arrested. And if you watch on the Iditarod Insider or any of the other videos of the teams coming into Nome, they pretty much all have bells when they come into Nome, even now. So that's a little tradition that has grown up. Also, in Nome, when a team is, I believe it's 2 miles or a mile and a half from the finish, they sound the fire alarm. So there's a big noise to let everybody within earshot know that a team is coming in. And that happens 24 hours a day. So if a team is coming in at 4 a.m, they will sound the siren and people will go out to the World Arch, to the finish line, and cheer them on. a couple of other things about Gnome. They have, this is a little bit silly, but they have a sort of golf tournament where they set up golf holes and little greens on the ice of the Bering Sea, and people can go out and try their hand at playing. I think it's 5 or 6 holes of ice golf. One of the things I was most fascinated by is that when people in Nome, when it's time to get rid of their Christmas trees, they bring their Christmas trees out onto the ice, and they have this area that is referred to locally as the Nome National Forest, where they have all of the discarded Christmas trees. One other thing that I just wanted to mention very briefly is if you are watching the teams come in on the Insider, sometimes the Insider has, there are two cameras set up on the arch. There's one looking out for the teams that are coming in, and there's one looking the other way, basically pointing towards the mini convention center and where the dog lot is. And if you watch when a team comes in or when a team is about to come in, you will always see Stu Nelson, who is the chief veterinarian for Iditarod, standing there. And he is a very tall guy, and he wears a green parka, so he's very distinctive. And if you watch him, he is there for every team who comes in, and he makes his way down the line, giving pats and affection to all of the dogs and doing a very brief cursory examination of all of the dogs just to make sure that there are no health issues or there is nothing important or life-threatening that needs to be dealt with the dogs. So from before the start to the very end of the race, he is there and his vets are there always looking at each of the dogs and making sure that the dogs are as healthy as they can be.
Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, we have never talked about Stu Nelson. I think that would be a great profile to do one of these times, because what a job. You know, a lot of these folks have so much going on in their lives. I don't even know if he has a practice outside of Iditarod. I don't know if he lives in Alaska. I don't know much about Stu other than Iditarod.
Yeah, I believe, and I'm not positive about this, but I believe he does live in Alaska and does have a practice. He's been chief vet for a while, for at least, I believe, 7 or 8 years. There's a staff of somewhere between 40 and 45 vets, all of whom are volunteers, and they leapfrog up and down the trail so that there are teams at each of the checkpoints where mushers are coming in, and they do, I believe he said they do somewhere in the neighborhood of 10,000 dog examinations on the trail every year. So there, being in charge of that and having to make sure that the volunteer vets are in the right place and that they are properly trained and that everything goes, according to what's best for the dogs, is a monumental undertaking. And he's a very quiet, soft-spoken, but very passionate guy. And every time I watch a team come in and I see him sort of standing off by the side waiting for them, I am thankful for everything that he does for the race, and just am so appreciative of all of the work that he has done and continues to do.
So what happens between when Dallas finished yesterday at about 4 o'clock in the morning up until the finisher's banquet? What's going on during that time, and what happens at the finisher's banquet for people that haven't seen it online or don't know much about it?
Well, there's a number of things. There are some formal events. There's a Meet the Mushers event that I think is usually on Saturday, where fans can come and talk to and meet all of the mushers and get memorabilia signed by all of the mushers, or at least all of the mushers who are there. The mushers have also come in from being out on the trail and not having a lot of time to sleep. Sometimes they haven't taken a shower in 4 or 5 or 6 days. So they want to take care of the dogs, get the dogs situated in the dog yard, which is just about 100 yards or so from the finish line. And then usually get something to eat, get some sleep, take a shower. Because they've been on this schedule where they don't get a lot of sleep, most people, when they come in, find that they are not able to, get 8 hours of sleep in a row, that they are frequently up, in the middle of the night and all of that. So they are a lot of the time out and about. It's not at all uncommon to see mushers who've already come in come out to greet the teams that are coming in. I know we've seen Ali Zirkel has been out for a couple of the teams that have come in. And there are a lot of things to do in Nome. It's sort of, the bars, I believe, are open until 4 in the morning. So people will sometimes be out drinking and partying until all hours of the night. And then the finisher's banquet is on Sunday, and there's a tradition at the finisher's banquet, which we haven't seen in probably the last, I think, 5 or 6 years. If a musher comes in during the banquet, everyone, I guess that doesn't literally mean everyone, but almost everyone, leaves the banquet and goes down to the finish line to greet the mushers who come in during the banquet. In the past few years, we've seen the Red Lantern come in before the banquet starts, so that doesn't happen. But in the past, when mushers have come in, they have just interrupted the banquet wherever they were. And at the banquet, they fly in, again, the chefs from the Millennium Hotel in Anchorage, which is one of the Iditarod sponsors, and they have this huge catered meal with fresh fruit and roast beef and everything you can imagine. So there's the meal part of it, and then they give awards. So all of the awards that were given on the race are re-given. And that includes the First of the Yukon Award, and all of the little, the First of the Halfway Point, the First of the Coast Award, all of those are re-presented. And there are also some additional awards, the award for Best Dog Care is given then, and if the Red Lantern is in already, the Red Lantern Award will be given. And then they go from the last musher in all the way up to the winner and introduce them, and the mushers all have a chance to speak and thank whoever they want to thank. And a lot of times mushers will tell stories about what happened to them on the trail or interesting or odd things that they encountered. Some of the mushers will just get up and thank one or two sponsors and their family and then get off the stage. But unlike the starting banquet, where they really try to limit the amount of time that people speak, there's pretty much no limit to how long people will speak at the finisher's banquet. So you can sometimes have this event just go on and on and on, which is kind of fascinating, because it's always, for me, it's always interesting to hear the stories that they want to tell and the people that they want to thank. And almost every musher who gets up there will thank the volunteers. And, you know, we've talked about this in the past, but this is a race that literally would not be able to survive if it were not for all of the volunteers. And there are thousands of them every year who come in and, you know, work in the checkpoints, work as handlers, work security, do all of these tasks that need to be done to make a 1,000-mile race work. So they thank the handlers. They almost always will thank their spouses or their children. And the stories that people tell at the banquet are always very heartfelt and wonderful. Almost everyone who is going to Nome will go to the finisher's banquet. Almost everyone who's there, you know, comes in from outside of Nome will go there. And a lot of people in the community will go as well. And in Nome, they have families will sign up to host mushers who come in from the trail. So you will have all of the people who are involved in that way in Iditarod will also be at the banquet. So it's a fairly large event. It's not as large as the banquet in Anchorage, which I think is 2,000 or 3,000 people, but it is probably between 500 and 1,000 people there.
Wow. And most of the teams will be flown out over the next couple of days. Almost all of them will be back before the musher gets back. So a lot of the handlers are already here in Anchorage picking up the teams that have been flown in on the airplane, and they're all shipped back in either crates. You have to send out crates or a dog box to Nome to get the dogs back to you. So I've been on that job several times for my friend Hugh, and I know what that takes. So a lot of the dog teams will be back, if not they aren't already back. I know Jeff flew out his team this morning from Nome, and his handlers picked them up, and they're already probably heading back up towards the Denali Park there. And that's pretty common occurrence there. So the air terminal will be very full for the next few days with all these teams, gear, and things coming back. And then, of course, the mushers will start to come back. I would assume most of them will come back Monday. Is that right, Alex?
Yeah. For the most part, they try to come back Monday. There's a limited amount of space in the dog lot, and that's part of the reason why they fly most of the teams back even before the mushers get back. The one exception is the team of the winning musher is allowed to stay in the dog lot until it's closed. So Dallas Seavey will not have to worry about having to send his dogs home early. He can hang around with his dogs in Nome and enjoy them, and everybody else who comes in can see Dallas's dogs.
And I'm sure from a dog perspective, they're very happy to get back home to their surroundings and their own dog houses and amongst their friends in the kennel. So at least in my circumstance, if I was in that position, I would want to get my team home as quickly as possible so that the family and or the handlers, whoever's helping you with your dogs, can do that at home. Alex, I've never asked you this question, and I know we got to go here right after. We've been doing this for several years, and I've never asked you if you could pick out one favorite part of the Iditarod from the beginning to the end. And I know you've seen it all. What is your most favorite part of the Iditarod experience for you?
You know, I think it comes down to the very end. And there's something called the Widow's Lamp, which is placed on the finish line on the Burled Arch in Nome. And it is literally a lamp that stays lit for as long as there are teams on the trail. And when the Red Lantern comes in, after they are checked in and interviewed and all of that happens, they take down the widow's lamp and they blow it out. Or in this case, because it's, you know, it's one of those modern lamps, they turn the switch to extinguish it. And that is what indicates the end of that year's Iditarod. And for me, being there when the widow's lamp was put out and seeing, you know, hundreds of people there to welcome the Red Lantern in and to let them put out and extinguish this lamp and officially end the Iditarod, for me, that really kind of rolled into it all of the experiences that everyone had had, and that was the moment that kind of brought them all together and officially put an end to the race.
Cool stuff. Alex, what's going to happen next for us here on the show? What are you doing over the next, I don't know, 11 months or so? What's happening with you and the rest of your year, I guess, if we could ask that?
You know, I am very happy that I'm coming back to Alaska in a few months. I'm actually going to be there in the summer. There is an organization called the New Old Time Chautauqua, which exists to bring theatrical experiences to underserved communities. So communities that are far enough away from cities where they never get theater or much live music. So there's a group of people who do this all over the country, and this year they are doing it in Alaska. And I will be there, I believe, starting right around the 4th of July, starting in Juneau, and then they're going to a number of places, and I believe finishing up in Sitka. And Juneau and Sitka are relatively large communities, but they're going to a lot of smaller communities. So I will be there making a documentary about that.
Alex, I can't help but think that sounds like Dennis Miller on the radio. We're going to be at so-and-so convention center on August 4th. Tickets are available online. And that's what you sound like when I heard that. Well, congratulations. If you're in my neck of the woods, we'll get together and have dinner or whatever's happening. What a great time that we always have here on the radio. And I know our fans really enjoy our banter. And I want to wish you well.
Yeah, it's always great sharing this experience with you, and let's keep doing it.
We will for sure. So on behalf of my good friend and co-host for Mushing Radio here during Iditarod, Alex Stein, you can follow him on Twitter at Coldfoot Films is his Twitter handle. I know he has Facebook pages and whatnot, but he is pretty active on Twitter. So if you aren't on Twitter, head on over and at least follow this guy. He's an excellent commentator there, not only during Iditarod, but throughout the year. Make sure you follow him over there. And Alex, we'll talk real soon, okay?
Yep. Okay, take care, Robert.
Thank you. So on behalf of all of us, we'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.